So I have the honor of introducing our speaker tonight, our presenter, Dr. Mike Sperber. Mike has a lot to offer us tonight. I think we're in for a treat. Actually, I'm going to tell you the story of how we came to be here. Last February, I went to a conference where Mike was presenting. And the conference was called Women of Resilience in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And his presentation was on Emily Dickinson. And it was a play as well. And Mike totally channeled Emily Dickinson, reciting her poetry, bringing her alive, without a word on a piece of paper or a video screen, totally by memory. And I was just floored and so inspired and impressed. And so when I got back to Gloucester, I was telling people about how fabulous his work was. And they said, well, why don't you ask him to perform this in Gloucester? So I did, and said the Writers' Center would be the perfect place. But before I knew it, Mike had decided that he was on to his next piece, and that that was so yesterday, and now he was working on something else. And he's going to be presenting this piece in Santa Fe at the summer conference, sponsored by the same group, only in the summer. The conference is Creativity and Madness. So Mike is warming up with us tonight and his play on Hamlet and the Buddha. So Mike didn't want me to say too much about him, but I kept insisting that you know a little bit of background. But as I look around, I think a lot of you know Mike, so you probably know the background. Some people don't. Okay. So Mike is a psychiatrist. He's in the neuropsychiatry service at McLean Hospital in Belmont. He was educated at Oberlin College, Brussels. He's done psychiatric residencies in Boston. He's taught at Harvard Medical School in psychiatry. He's a published author of, I'll mention a couple of his works, Henry David Thoreau, Cycles and Psyche, Dostoevsky's Stalker, Essays on Psychopathology and the Arts, and Psychiatry and Genetics, Psychosocial, Ethical, and Legal Considerations. So I wanted you to know this because you will see what's informed what he's written tonight. He's been a great inspiration and mentor for me in my practice of holistic psychotherapy. So without further ado, Dr. Mike Sperber.
Starting standing.
Sure, that'd be good. All thanks, right. Henry. Thank you so much for coming tonight. It's an honor and a privilege to have you all with me. Buddha and Hamlet in Bedlam is a one-act play with four scenes. All four scenes take place on the grounds of McLean Hospital. McLean Hospital is the inpatient psychiatric facility. It's affiliated with Harvard Medical School. The time is the present. Scene one, Hamlet's bedroom at McLean. As the curtain rises, Hamlet is staring at a portrait of his recently deceased father. The portrait is framed in black. and Hamlet speaks. How weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. What's that? I hear a knocking. Who's there? What's happening? It is I, Dr. Frank Faith, staff psychiatrist at McLean Hospital. You asked me to give you a second opinion about your psychiatric diagnosis and your recommendations for treatment and some adverse side effects that you've had. Oh, thank you so much for coming, Dr. Faith. Well, I'm not really clear what is your diagnosis now and why you wanted a second opinion about it. I feel I've been misdiagnosed, Dr. Faith. When I arrived, they told me that I was psychotic, and they shot me shot me up with antipsychotic medications, and I've had a lot of side effects. It's called Parkinsonism. I have this tremor. They call it a pill-rolling tremor. My face is more or less unexpressive, and I don't blink much. And I have a shuffling, fascinating gait, as if I'm trying to catch up with my center of gravity. My back is bowed over like the bows I used to use in archery. My muscles are so rigid, my handwriting is minuscule and almost indecipherable. Oh, horrible. Oh, horrible. Most horrible. I was hoping you could maybe re-diagnose my situation and come up with a different diagnosis and possibly a different treatment. This treatment is not helping me at all. Well, I'd do anything that I could to help you, of course. Tell me a little bit about yourself, why you came to the hospital. I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth, foregone all custom of exercises, and indeed it goes so heavily with my disposition that this goodly frame, the earth, this excellent canopy of air, this brave o'erhanging firmament, this majestical roof fretted with golden fire, seems to me but a foul and pestilent congregation of vapors. What a piece of work is a man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, in form and shape, how admirable and expressive. In action, how angelic. In apprehension, how godlike. The beauty of the world, the paragon of the animals, but to me, the quintessence of dust. Well, Hamlet How did this morbid melancholia begin? I was studying at the University of Wittenberg in Germany. I have a passion, playwriting and poetry. And I learned of the untimely death of my beloved father. He was a Hyperion, a sun god to me. Well, I put on my charcoal black suit to return home to Elsinore in Denmark to grieve and mourn. But when I arrived, I was shocked. There was a wedding celebration going on. My mother had hastily remarried my dead father's younger brother, and they were celebrating the marriage. My mother urged me, "Cast off thy inky attire. Gentle Hamlet, surely you must know what lives must die and pass through nature to eternity." And my stepfather, who was like a satyr, a goat with horse's ears and a horse's tail and a lascivious behavior, said to me, "Hamlet, your father died, and your father's father died, and his father died. To persist in obstinate condolement is a course of impious stubbornness. It is unmanly grief. It is a will incorrect with nature. It is a heart lacking in fortitude. It is a mind impatient and an understanding unschooled and simple. Let's toast, Hamlet. The king is dead. Long live the king." Well, I drank, not to celebrate anything he had said, but to numb my pain. And then I had another glass and another glass. And then I needed fresh air, and I climbed to the battlements of the castle. And I collapsed, overwhelmed with grief, unexpressed grief. And I had the worst nightmare I've ever had in my life. I saw my father dying, and there was an explosion, as if a bomb had been detonated. Everything white. My father had given up the ghost, and I bolted upright. And there, with my own eyes, very eyes, in broad daylight, I saw him, the ghost of my dead father. And he told me he had been murdered and to take revenge on the murderer. What was I to do? Was this a visitation from hell? A goblin tempting me to sin of murder? Or an apparition from heaven, commanding me to rectify a terrible injustice? I had an idea. My passion is playwriting. I would write a play depicting exactly what the ghost of my father said. I'd call it the mousetrap. I would catch the conscience of the king. The next day, there was a performance by a group of local thespians. They were going to play The Murder of Gonzaga. I asked them, could they insert my play within their play? They said, yes, they could do that. So the next day, I pulled my chair up close to where King Claudius was sitting. I riveted my focus on his face, especially when the player, the villain, was going to pour the leprous distillation into the player king's ears. King Claudius, when that happened, bolted upright. Stop the play, stop the play, lights, lights! He turned to my mother, Gertrude, your son is crazy. Why write a heinous, macabre drama like this, murder? My mother said, yes, I can't get him to take off his knighted clothes. So the two conspired to commission Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, those dolts from college, to escort me to the United States and have me committed at McLean Hospital. When we arrived, I tried to have turn the tables and have them committed, but when the admitting psychiatrist learned that I had heard and seen the ghost of my dead father, who said he was murdered, he said, Hamlet, the two characteristics of psychosis, false perceptions, hallucinations, and false beliefs, delusions, you have them. I will give you some antipsychotic medication. It'll be just the way you were before. Dr. Faith, is there something that you could do to review the records? Maybe I only had that hallucination maybe one time, maybe two times. I'm aware that I have a sore distraction, my madness. I'm aware of that, but of course no psychotic patient has ever said that they were rightly diagnosed. I know that, but in this case, it's so. Well, I will get your records from Wittenberg, the infirmary, and from the clinic at Elsinore, and from the admissions unit here at McLean, and from the ward. I'll put it all together. Why don't you come to my office? It'll take about a month, and I'll go over my findings with you. Oh, I would appreciate that very much, Dr. Faith. Scene two, the chapel where Dr. Faith has his office. The curtain rises on the sunlight streaming through the stained glass windows. There's quiet organ music in the background. Bach's Sheep May Safely Graze. And the fragrance of lavender incense permeates the atmosphere of the sanctuary. Dr. Faith is staring at the axis of symmetry in the stained glass window, listening to Bach's pastoral cadences, taking in the fragrance of the incense. There's a knocking at the door. Come in, Hamlet, I've been expecting you. Welcome. Thank you, Dr. Faith. Tell me, have I been misdiagnosed? You have been, unfortunately. And the medications? Worthless, of no value in your particular instance. Well, what is my diagnosis? As the admitting psychiatrist said, you had the two characteristics of psychosis: false perceptions, false beliefs. When these occur in the context of sleep, they're not called psychosis. They're called parasomnias. Para alongside somnias, to sleep. The parasomnia that you had is called a hypnopompic hallucinations. 10% of the population have parasomnias. The particular type of hallucination that you had led to an important discovery in chemistry. What was that, Dr. Faith? In 1858, Frederick Augustus Kekulé, a chemist from Germany, was a visiting professor at the University of Ghent. It was bitter cold that winter, and he had spread out the papers for his textbook of chemistry, which he was writing. When he got to benzene, he was perplexed. He had too many hydrogen. What was the molecular structure of benzene? He got closer to the fire to warm himself, and he dozed off, as you did in the battlements. His was the warmth of from the fire. Yours was the warmth from the alcohol. And he awoke with a startled, and he saw in the flames a snake devouring its tail, and he realized the structure of benzene was a ring, and that was the birth of organic chemistry. Benzene structures with benzene in it. He used the woe to grow, and we're going to do that with your hallucination, Prince Hamlet, because your hallucination that was not psychopathology. That was a normal phenomenon that happens. Yours was so traumatic to you that you developed what we call post-traumatic stress syndrome or disorder. That's when it's so traumatic the ego can't deal with it, and then you develop symptoms, and you had several of them. The ones that you had included what's called psychic numbing or emotional anesthesia. When Ophelia, your beloved, said she wanted to have sex with you, you said, "Get thee to a nunnery. Why be a breeder of sinners?" You knew a nunnery, yes, a residence for nuns, but a whorehouse. In effect, you told your beloved Ophelia, because she wanted sex, that she was a whore. And when you were in your mother's bedroom, hypervigilance is another symptom. You saw a movement behind the tapestry between her bedroom and the wall. You saw a movement there, and you lunged with your rapier Fortunately, it did not penetrate the tapestry, because you could have killed Polonius. Ophelia was so disturbed by what you had said, she was wandering around and he was searching for her. Could have killed him. And nightmares, that's another symptom of PTSD. You told the head nurse, I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself the king of infinite space were it not that I have bad dreams. What do I do about this situation, Dr. Faith? Well, we've discontinued the antipsychotic medication, and we're going to treat the stress disorder with body, mind, and spirit. Body, diet, and exercise. For diet, skip the antibiotics, the growth hormones, the pesticides, go organic. It's a little pricey, but surely the king of the Prince of Denmark will be able to afford it, even without Blue Cross Blue Shield. For exercise, you've foregone all custom of exercises. At McLean, we can provide horseback riding, archery, fencing, something each day. For spirit, I'm going to teach you a little bit about meditation. I want you to develop a meditative practice. What I did before you came to empty my mind of nonsense, I looked at the axis of symmetry in the stained glass window. I drew a little circle where the lines intersect. And anything that you focus on intensely, one pointed discrimination alters consciousness. It's called self-hypnosis. I want for you, if you forget everything about this session, to remember, get sensible of what you can touch, taste, smell, see, and hear. I'll give you an exercise for each of your five senses. Sight, we already mentioned. For sound, Thoreau made an interesting discovery. He said, all sound is music. Wherever you are, just listen to the sound. It will distract you from thinking. You have what we call a reverberating circuit going round and round, churning night and day. Three parts of your brain. What three parts? I'm glad you asked, because it turns out we are writing a play together, and it could be boring if we get too technical. The prefrontal cortex, the amygdala, emotions, and the hippocampus for memory. They never stop reverberating. What you can touch, taste, smell, see, and hear disrupts that circuit. Your mind is emptied of the nonsense. For taste and smell, well, the fragrance of the incense here, if you take a little birch bark and chew it, and just aware of the flavor of the birch bark. And hearing. You can hear the Bach in the background. See if you can visualize the right hand playing the high notes and the left the low notes. Visualize as well as hear. That will distract your mind from thinking. The goal is to distract your mind from thinking by being sensible. But the most important of all for you is what we're going to call narrative therapy. It's a form of cognitive behavioral therapy. Everybody, we all have a story to tell. And when we don't tell it, we act it out instead of writing it out or dancing it out. Now, since you love playwriting, write from the time that you learned that your father had died, include the part at the wedding feast. The funeral baked meat did furnish forth the wedding table. That was shocking to you. Write it out. And then the part where your pain was numbed at McLean Hospital by that antipsychotic medication, Haldol. Now, it's very important that you, body, mind, and spirit, that you involve yourself in these relaxation techniques, because in a month, Shakespeare has it that Laertes has challenged you to a duel. He was outraged. He called his sister, Ophelia, a whore, and could have killed his father. Rewrite that scene, or you're going to both be dead. Thank you for the tip. I can see you are prescient, Dr. Frank Faith. Let's meet in a month at the fitness center. They've changed the room around for a fencing chamber there. And let's see what happens. I'm looking forward to that, Dr. Frank Faith. Scene 3, the fencing chamber. Prince Hamlet and Dr. Faith are standing at the door awaiting Laertes. They came a little earlier. And Hamlet says to Dr. Faith, I rewrote the last Shakespeare's last act. In my version, nobody dies. I want you to hear the way I rewrote it. I'm all ears, Prince Hamlet. Hola! Laertes, hola! It's Hamlet. Give me your hand, Laertes. But give me your pardon, for I have done you wrong. But pardon it, as you are a gentleman. This presence knows, and you must needs have heard, that I have been punished by a sore distraction, my madness. Was it Hamlet that wronged Laertes? Never Hamlet. If Hamlet from himself be taken away, and when he is not Hamlet, dost wrong Laertes. Who doest it? Never Hamlet. Hamlet is of the faction wronged by his madness. His madness is poor Hamlet's enemy. Sir, by my disclaiming of a purposed evil, so free me in your most gentle thoughts that I have shot my arrow over the house and hurt my brother. Laertes, for the love of God, let's not fence. we go horseback riding and said, yes, when the horses quench their thirst in the Beaverbrook Reservation at the bottom of the hill, we can find tongues in trees, books in running brooks, sermons in stone, and good in everything. I would love that, Prince Hamlet. Dr. Faith, now that I understand that my madness is my enemy, to use your parlance, it's my madness is ego dystonic. I plan two moves, and I'd like to share them with you. I'd love to hear them. Let's meet on the Sabbath in the treehouse up on the hill. That would be fine with me. Scene 4. The treehouse. The treehouse is a miniature house cradled in the branches of an enormous oak. Hamlet and Dr. Faith survey the scene. Hamlet speaks. Some spend the Sabbath going to the chapel. I spend it in my treehouse home with the bobolink as my choirster, the orchard as my dome. Did you know, Dr. Faith, that the orchard, all these trees, this site was selected by Frederick Law Olmsted? The landscape architect for America, he selected close to 600 public spaces, Central Park, Prospect Park, the Emerald Necklace of Boston, the campus of Berkeley, of Stanford, Niagara Falls Reservation, the Capitol Grounds. He had a terrible stress disorder. He saw his mother take her life. But he had an earlier memory. She was holding him in her lap, reading to him under an enormous tree, in the shade of a tree. And wherever he was, trees were very important to him. I'm the beneficiary of Olmsted's stress disorder. He used his woe to grow. So I wrote a little poem about that. The obstacle is the path. Use woe to grow. You'll smile and you will laugh. You'll know and you'll glow. That's quite lovely, Prince Hamlet. And you said you're moving on in life now that you know your madness is your enemy. Yes. The first jewel is my beloved Ophelia. I apologize profoundly. I told her about my madness being such an impediment in our relationship. And I wrote a sonnet and I dedicated it to her. I had to write a beautiful sonnet. Shakespeare said he wrote the sonnet. I wrote it. It had to be beautiful because, you know, you tell your beloved that she's a whore, not good. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh no, it is an ever fixed mark that looks at tempest and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark, whose height is known but its worth not taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within its bended compass come. Love alters not its brief hours and days, but bears it out until the edge of doom. If this be error, and upon me proved, I never writ, and no man ever loved. And then I told her, doubt that the sun is fire, doubt that the moon doth move, doubt truth to be a liar, but never doubt my love. Well, I'm so pleased that you found a lost jewel. My second jewel that I found is a vocation. I've been watching and listening to you, Dr. Faith, and I've decided there's something rotten in the state of Denmark. Booze, butts, pills, potions, pot. The medical model for psychiatry may be a little better than witchcraft, but not that much. It left me with all those side effects, misdiagnosed me. I've decided to become a holistic psychiatrist. And we're going to get married, go to Denmark, and all the people who died in Shakespeare's tragedy about my life, they're going to dance around when we swap rings and swap vows. It was a lover and his lass in springtime, the only living ring time when birds do sing. Hey, ding a ding a ding, hey, ding a ding a ding, hey, ding a ding a ding, sweet love is love, the spring. Well, Hamlet. I've enjoyed reading your play. Of course, it's not Shakespeare, but from a certain point of view, that's hearsay. You know your life better than he. But one problem perplexed me. You've entitled your play Buddha and Hamlet in Bedlam. Where's the Buddha? There's no Buddha in the play. I'm not the Buddha. Maybe there's some kind of transference to me as Hyperion, a sun god. I'm glad you asked. The Buddha speaks the last six lines of, I say my play, but it's really our play. This is a dialogue between you and me. Sperber just narrated it, you know, we wrote it down. But when we write, that's the Buddha's awakened, so he speaks the last lines. Aum. Prince, doctor, closely joined. Two sides of the same coin. Prince's ire cut off from doctor's love, murderous hand out of restraining glove. Prince and doctor for showing us the way, heartfelt gratitude and Namaste.